Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Tuesday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Help for HD Radio. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host. Glad to be back with you today. And tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. That's the toll-free. When you call in, press 1. I'll cue you into the show. Please don't hesitate to call in and ask questions. Tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 87,000 listeners out there, for your support and interest in Help for HD programming. And tonight we're very happy to have Dr. Speed with us. She is a PhD and is a pharmacist. She works in the pharmaceutical industry as a regulatory affairs and drug development consultant. After working for Sanofi Winthrop in the UK, United Kingdom, and Novartis in Switzerland, she moved to the United States. She worked for three small companies in the United States and now runs her own consulting practice. Dr. Speed sat on an important NIH committee for the development of new treatments for rare diseases. She's also the founder of a nonprofit called Rare Diseases Patients First, and this organization is planning to provide education to patients with rare diseases about the clinical trial process, and this education will be provided free of charge. She will provide more information about these educational internet-based meetings as soon as they're ready to be rolled out later this year. And Dr. Speed advises companies on development of new treatments for rare diseases. She saw a need to provide information to patients about clinical trials that would allow them to be empowered, which is what we all need, and enough to ask the right questions before and after entering clinical trials. She also wrote the book Clinical Trials, What Patients and Healthy Volunteers Need to Know, and tonight we're going to be talking about that book. She's offering the book at a special price to us for $13.95. I'm going to post the link and the promotion code so that we can get a hold of this book. I'm looking forward to reading it myself. And this book will provide information on the development of new treatments. It's about education and the process for clinical trials and how it all happens. So today we invite and we speak with Dr. Speed, and we're so happy to meet you, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Melissa. It is a real pleasure to be here today. I have been so impressed with this organization.
Oh, thank you.
It is always nice to be able to interact with patients, and as a pharmacist, I have that very unique interest as well as the skill set that goes along with that. But to be able to meet an organization and work with an organization that is working in the trenches with patients with Huntington's disease is very unique. And I think that's what sets you apart. Today, what I'm going to do is to talk about the drug development process. As Melissa has said, I have a background after studying pharmacy. I went into the pharmaceutical industry. And I'm going to talk about how drugs are developed, and that's why I wrote the book, because I knew that the whole process of drug development is a very complex process. All diseases are very complex, and Huntington's disease is a very complex disease, just like most others. And how we study that disease process and how we find new treatments is through clinical trials and through animal studies. And so I want to talk a little bit about that, explain how the process works. And then I really want to delve into the informed consent process. And then I'm hoping that at some point I can take your questions and provide some answers to concerns. I cannot address specific medical conditions. You would have to go to your physicians for that. But we can address concerns that are fairly general across the listeners today. And then if there are unique areas that I can provide input on an individual basis, we'll do that offline rather than over the air. So as many of you are aware, Huntington's disease has many different components to it. It results from a genetic mutation on the fourth chromosome, and the abnormality causes the death of vital nerve cells in the region of the brain known as the basal ganglia. The disease currently affects 35,000 to 50, 50,000 Americans and about 175,000 to 250,000 additional people at risk of developing it during their lifetimes. The numbers in your own countries, because I know that some of you come from other countries that are listening to this radio program, may be a little bit different, but the proportion is about the same.
Mm-hmm.
The pharmaceutical industry needs to develop treatments. We need to be reimbursed for the treatments once they are developed. And rare diseases, which this would qualify as, are sometimes put on the back burner, and but that's changing, thankfully. More companies, even the large pharmaceutical companies, are now spending quite substantial amounts of money on rare diseases. And the process of developing the treatments hopefully would result in investors that put money into the development of the treatments getting a return on their investment. And the more the return on the investment, the more the interest to find treatments in those disease areas. So we won't spend a lot of time on that as the business aspect of the pharmaceutical industry, but that is a very important consideration. So when treatments are developed, the drugs are developed in phases. So we always start out with the animal studies. We like to have models to be able to study the disease area. And one of the problems of Huntington's disease is that animals tend not to get this disease. And so we have to create models. We have to create sort of artificial systems in which we can study the disease. There are a number of components to the disease which also increases the difficulty of studying the disease. It manifests itself in different patients, also in different ways. But the clinical trials aim to standardize the process of studying. If we can't standardize, then it becomes more difficult to study a small enough number of patients, so the studies become very expensive. So we always try to standardize in the clinical trial process and reduce the numbers if we can. And also, because this is a relatively rare disease, thankfully, we also need to keep the numbers in the clinical trials at a reasonable level. Otherwise, the studies become extremely expensive. Variability can also make it difficult to see the impact of the drug under study. So if different patients react to a study drug in different ways, that also increases the difficulty of studying the drug. There are different types of clinical trials that could be run in, that are being run in Huntington's disease. So there are treatments that treat, that there are studies that are looking at drugs that potentially treat the symptoms. There may be others that are looking at the genetic causes of the disease, and there are a number of other areas that they are looking at in terms of cognition, impact of drugs on cognition, and also other aspects of the disease, emotion, for instance. And depression is another aspect that could be studied and is being studied. So when a patient or a carer is considering a clinical trial, it's important to be clear on what is the purpose of the study and what is the potential for benefit from taking part in the study. And that is something that patients can ask questions around. So the informed consent process, which I'll get into in a little bit, it requires that you ask questions as well as be asked questions. It's also important to study to ask questions about the types of side effects that you can expect.
Is that covered through the consent process?
That's right. So let's talk a little bit about I want to talk a little bit about the informed consent process.
Okay.
And the informed consent process is a process that is ongoing. So even if you go, let's say you go into a physician's office and you're going to have a procedure, the physician would usually, by law, require that you sign a document giving him him or her the authorization to carry out that procedure. It's the same in a clinical trial. Before you can take part in a clinical trial, it's important that you are evaluated to see if you qualify, first of all, to take part in a clinical trial. And if you meet the so-called inclusion and exclusion criteria for that clinical trial, then you will be informed consented. So that means they will go through and explain what the study is about, also what the goals of the study are, and what procedures you can expect to undergo during the study, how long you'll be in the study for, all the different aspects of the methodology of the study. And then if you agree to that, you will sign the form, and that means that you have been informed consented. But it is not a one-time event, or it shouldn't be. It is usually, it should be an event where you give your informed consent, you go into the study, and then throughout the study, you are continually being updated on what's going on in the study, because when you join the study, there could be adverse reactions that occur with other patients that might require that you be informed consented again. So if something happens to another patient in another dose group, then you should be called in again and be informed consented after you've been given an updated informed consent document to review, and then you should be given the opportunity to re-sign that informed consent. So it's not a one-off. It's a continuing process of informed consent. It involves discussion with the investigator, but where there are patients with Huntington's disease that may be cognitively impaired, some special considerations would have to be taken into account. So we can get into that if people are interested in that area. But obviously, if a patient is not able to give informed consent because their cognition has been impacted in a certain way, then there has to be protection of that so-called vulnerable subject to make sure that if they're put into the study, it's in their best interest to be in that study. If a patient experiences disease progression, the disease is getting worse even though they're in the study, then again, that might also require that there's a re-informed consenting, or at least a re-evaluation of whether it is in their best interest to be in that clinical trial, especially if the whole purpose of the clinical trial was the efficacy of the drug to address the disease progression. And also it depends on what aspect of the disease was being studied. Usually what happens is the protocol has been written in such a way in that if there is a disease progression, then the patient would be removed from the clinical trial. But it, again, because this is a multifaceted aspect, a multifaceted disease, there may be a part of the disease under study and another part is progressing. And so we've got to be paying careful consideration to that in terms of what's in the best interest of the patient. So in terms of some questions and answers that you should expect, in the book that Melissa mentioned, there are a list of questions that you can ask the investigator before you go into the study. I'm just going to quickly go through pick up one or two of them.
Okay.
And even before you ask the investigator questions, it's important that you ask yourself some questions. For instance, do I understand what the potential benefit to me of being in the study is? Is this the best clinical trial for me to take part in? Given what I know about this clinical trial, is there an acceptable risk to my health? So this really relates to what do I know about the clinical trial? Do I know enough about it? Have I done my homework on it? And another question to ask is, does the clinical trial involve research of an unproven or experimental nature or drug? How long is the clinical trial expected to last? Are there any procedures that will cause discomfort or put my health at risk? What are the possible benefits to me of my participation in this clinical trial? And you should be able to name some benefits depending on the phase of the study. if you're a patient going into a study, usually there is a potential for benefit. Mm-hmm. Are there any procedures or treatments that would be more appropriate for me to consider than this clinical trial? Will this trial, for instance, delay my receiving effective treatment that is already available? Also, do I need to be admitted into the hospital during the clinical trial? Is this going to disrupt my life in other ways? And who will provide my day-to-day care while this trial is ongoing? And if I experience an adverse reaction while I'm in the trial, what will I need to do? Who will pay for my treatment if I am injured in some way? So those are some questions to ask, and I don't know how you want to handle that, Melissa. Should I just carry on, or should we try to see if we can take
some questions? Well, as time goes on, I may get questions in the chat room from people.
Okay.
So I may be interrupting just with questions. I do have a couple of questions. One is, what is considered a rare disease? Now, and you know, I've heard that it's 200,000 in the U.S., but I don't know in other countries what is considered rare disease. Do you?
So there's the European standard. The different territories have different standards, but there's ultra-rare and then there's rare. So there's different numbers given in different territories. So in the U.S., it's about less than anything. Patient numbers that are less than 250,000 would be considered a rare disease.
Uh-huh.
So the ultra-rare, though, could be a lot less than that. So it could be, and it depends on the population size as to whether the disease would qualify as a rare disease or not. But in general, anything less than 250,000 in the U.S., so any diseases that have less than 250,000 people with that disease in the whole of the population of the U.S., would be considered rare, and it's about the equivalent number in Europe. And the ultra rare would be perhaps one in a million or something like that. So it's very, very small numbers of patients with an ultra rare disease.
And so then, if it's a rare disease, then is it different? Is there a different process for research and drug development and that kind of thing for rare?
In a way, there is a slightly different process in terms of the mechanism for getting the treatments approved. So to get the treatment commercialized, the studies would necessarily be smaller, because if you have a disease like rheumatoid arthritis, which is a much more common disease than a rare disease like Huntington's disease, the numbers of people that have to be studied have to be proportionate to the numbers of people that have the disease, so the studies are much larger. The rare disease patient population may be very small, so if you have a very rare disease, there may be very few patients in a single country that has the disease, and so the difficulty of studying that disease increases, and so the study sizes reduce in size.
Is it easier to study a rare disease than a disease that's not more rare?
It's a very good question. I do not think it is easier. I think it's a different set of, it may be a set of challenges that is somewhat different to studying a more common disease. So the challenges may be challenges of finding patients, whereas with a very common disease like rheumatoid arthritis or a cardiovascular disease, then there are many, many people around with the disease, but those are the diseases lots of companies want to study. So their challenge there would be competition for the patients that are out there. And for rare diseases, there may be much less patients. You've got to find the patients and bring them to the sites or the centers where they can be studied and take part in the clinical trials. So it's a different set of issues and challenges. I don't necessarily believe it's easier to study those diseases. But the health authorities, like the FDA and EMA in Europe, are trying to make it easier to get registration. So they're trying to facilitate the process. But the standards of drug safety and efficacy still have to be met. So it's still a challenging endeavor to undertake. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Oh, there she goes. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to mute. Can you go ahead? carry on with the next.
While you quieten your dog, I'll just give a few questions to ask the investigator before enrolling in the clinical trial. So one of the questions could be, before you go into the trial, when you're sitting down with the investigator during the informed consent process, could be, what sorts of adverse events might I experience during my participation in the clinical trial? Number two, what types of toxicities, and toxicities are really adverse reactions, were experienced by the animals during the good laboratory practice toxicology studies? So these are studies that are carried out in the animals. So where there have been situations where patients have been injured, there have been times where the physicians were unaware of the toxic findings in the animal study. So it's always a good idea to know what the toxicities were in the animal studies before the drug gets into patients. So you can ask those types of questions to get an understanding of were these studies carried out in rats, were they carried out in mice, or were they carried out in primates? And what were those toxicities, what were the dose levels? So just get a general feel for what is the level of difference between what was done in the animal studies and what is planned for in the human studies. After enrolling in the clinical trial, then there may be other patients that are taking part in the clinical trial that have experienced adverse reactions, and you'd want to know that. You'd want to know, were there other patients before you joined the trial that experienced adverse reactions? If so, did they fully recover from those adverse reactions, or did they have long-term effects from the adverse reactions? Also, what doses were they getting in the clinical trial? Were those doses lower than the dose you're planning to take part in, or were they higher than the doses that you may be taking part in? And also, it would be a good idea to know what phase the drug is currently in. If it's a phase 3 drug, then it's close to registration, and is closer to registration, for instance, than a phase 1 study. And if it's a phase 2 study, then they're still trying to find out if the drug works in the disease, or they're still trying to find an appropriate dose level. So they're trying to find how much to give the patients in phase 2. If it's in phase 3, then they already have an idea of the dose, and they're trying to confirm that the drug works at that particular dose. One important question to ask is, have there been any deaths in the clinical trial? And you want to know that after you're in the study, just in case something happened that you might need to know in terms of whether you still want to continue in the study. So if there has been a death, even if it was considered unrelated, you might want to make your own evaluation of that and decide, is this something that you consider that it might be a risk for you, and whether you want to continue to be in the study or not. And then if they conducted any additional toxicology studies after you joined the clinical trial, you should ask if there were any differences in those toxicology studies that were done to those that were done previously. And does that make any difference in terms of your risk profile for continuing to be in the study? Now, after you have finished the study, after you've gone out of the study may still be going on with other patients. And so this is an opportunity for you at the end of your participation in this study to really evaluate yourself and see if you've experienced any adverse events that occurred while you were participating in the clinical trial. So anything that you observed that was different to what you were experiencing before you went into the clinical trial, it would be a good idea to bring that to the attention of the investigator, even if you don't think it's related to the drug. And that way they can inform the company that's conducting, or the institution that's conducting the clinical trial, so they can get a good idea after they put all the data together over whether this drug may have that effect as an adverse reaction to it, or an adverse effect.
So observations, then, I'm going to ask you real quick. Observations could be from the caregiver or the person who's volunteered to help the individual who's in the clinical trial.
Very good point, Melissa, because there may be other people, caregivers, parents, relatives who notice something, perhaps in the behavior of the person even, or in their mood, and they may want to bring that to the attention of the investigator.
Okay, we have another question. Are there set parameters for the different phases of clinical trials, so 1, 2, and 3? And are there set numbers of subjects that these clinical trials are looking for?
Yes, yes. And it would obviously be a little bit different. There's a set number in general, but for the rare diseases, it could vary as well. So the numbers of patients for phase one are, phase one usually gets carried out in healthy volunteers, but it can also be carried out in patients. And the numbers of subjects in those studies could vary in a single study. Maybe it could be 15, could be 20, could be 30. In phase two, the numbers get a little bit larger because you're actually trying to find a dose, and the statistics of trying to find a dose because of variability between research subjects means that you have to have a little bit more in terms of the numbers of patients, so that where the variability is there in terms of the dose effect, it almost cancels itself out, so you can see what the true effect is the larger the study. So the numbers of patients in the phase two studies are a little bit more in each study of phase two than in phase one. And phase three, those studies are quite large. But this is all relative to the rare disease. It gets scaled down. And the types of findings that you're looking for in a phase one is really trying to find the dose. And you're also trying to find out how the drug is behaving in the human subject. So you're trying to look at the so-called pharmacokinetics, how much drug is in the blood, how much drug gets into different tissues, where does the drug go, in other words, and how much of it remains there before it gets excreted from the body. And you're also trying to relate those types of findings to efficacy and also to safety. So if someone experienced an adverse reaction, then you're trying to relate the adverse reaction to the level that was in the blood. In phase two, you're trying to find the dose. So you're trying to use the information that you have from phase one, build on that, and find the dose level that could be potentially effective. And in phase three, you're taking the dose that you observed in phase two, and you're confirming that that dose really does have efficacy. So it really does produce the effect that you want to see in the patients, whatever that effect might be. So in Huntington's disease, there's a component that might cause depression. So you want to, in patients with Huntington's disease, if your drug is to impact depression, then you might want to see that the patient has an elevated mood. That's what you're measuring. And you want to find the dose that will do that. If it's to really reduce the impact of movement disorders, then you want to find the dose that will normalize the movement. And if it's another aspect of emotion, for instance, or some other type of finding that you're trying to measure, then that's what you're going to be measuring. So in a cardiovascular therapeutic area, looking perhaps at blood pressure, an anti-obesity drug, you'd be looking to see the patient lose weight. So whatever it is that you're measuring it at the dose in phase two, but then you're also confirming it in phase three in slightly larger numbers of patients. So there are definitely parameters that these studies are carried out within.
Are any of the phases ever repeated? Like, for example...
Yeah, you can, yes, yeah. Definitely. And there are times when it's necessary to repeat the phase. In actual fact, there could be a number of studies in phase one, a number of studies in phase two, and a number of studies in phase three. And what is happening increasingly now, because companies are trying to really get to the end point where they can market the drug as quickly as possible. So what's happening is that you could be in phase three for an indication and in phase one for a different indication. So there's an overlap often of the
phases. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Interesting. Very interesting. So basically the parameters are based on the actual, the rarity of the disease or the number of people affected, or?
Yes, that has an impact. And if you're, for instance, going to carry out a study in a disease like Huntington's disease, you might be able to find all the patients you need in the United States. But what happens increasingly is to be able to do the study in a time frame that is realistic, and let's say you want to complete the study, find out if the drug is working, because there are so many other studies ongoing in the U.S., you might want to go to other parts of the world and recruit patients with Huntington's disease, and you might want to have a number of different sites in different parts of the world recruiting patients at the same time. So that those are the operational logistics of running these types of studies so that you can get it done. Rather than in 2 years, you might be able to cut the time down to a year or 6 months, depending on how many sites.
Now, are there any clinical trials happening in Mexico?
Oh, yes. I don't know. I haven't found any for Huntington's disease, but I wasn't specifically looking at that. But there's a website in the U.S. called clinicaltrials.gov, and you can go on and just search for – there are many, many studies for Huntington's disease, and you will see which locations they're in. So if there's a site – if there's a main study in the U.S., often there will be sites in Mexico as well.
Okay. And what about South America?
Yes. It depends on where the investigators are that the company wants to work with. So if a company wants to work with a specific investigator and they're based in South America, in Argentina or any of the other South American countries, then he just has to apply to their ethics committee and also to the health authority and get permission, and then the investigator can take part in the clinical trial. That's where the main site is here in the U.S., or the main site could be in another country.
Well, I know that the Huntington's organizations in Mexico, namely there's three in Mexico City, are very interested in participating in clinical trials. They have none there for Huntington's. We're trying to figure out how we can get them participating. We're trying to find pharmaceutical companies who might like to go there and conduct some trials.
I'm sure that if they're a qualified site, so qualification requires that they also are qualified to do studies in patients. Mm-hmm. So they have to be specialists in treating patients with Huntington's disease. They have to have enough patients coming through to justify the investment, but if they meet those criteria, then I would think that the sponsors of these trials, companies, would be very interested in speaking to them and going down and meeting with them and qualifying the site so that that can be a site for the studies in future that they're conducting.
Would it have to be a clinic or an institution?
It depends on what the study is going to require. So it could be outpatient. They could be an outpatient clinic. It could be an inpatient hospital. It depends on what the study is going to require, that the patient, how the patient is going to have to be evaluated. I would expect that a lot of the studies would be sufficient with an outpatient setting, but where the patient can come in and be evaluated in that clinic setting.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you heard of any mobile clinical trial opportunities?
Any?
So, for example, if somebody's in a rural area, has anyone ever done clinical trials, taken the clinical trials to the person?
I'm sure there are situations where that has been done. Let's say that there are patients in a rural setting, and let's just take the U.S. situation, then with the rare disease, especially in the ultra-rare situation, you want to find where all these patients are. So you put them on a map, and you're doing everything you can to bring them in to get treatment. So it may mean that you're flying them in, arranging for them to take the train or to be transported to the site. So because the patients, getting as many patients as you can as quickly as possible into the studies, then the fact that they're in a rural area should not prevent them from taking part in a clinical trial if the investigators and the sponsors know where they are. So with rare diseases, a lot of effort made to go over and above what would normally be done in a normal clinical trial.
Interesting.
And I think that because a patient lives in a rural area, that shouldn't prevent them from getting the potential benefit of taking part in a clinical trial. I think it's really important that they're given the opportunity that everybody else has. But obviously, it's going to be a communication aspect to that too, in that they need to communicate with the people. They need to know that the opportunity is there for them.
Right. Communication and transportation.
And the expense, yeah. And that's what can happen in a clinical trial, is that the expense can be met by the sponsor. So the sponsor can pay for their transportation, can pay for the drug that they would receive, whether it's the drug under study or a comparator. So it's a great opportunity for people to, once they've asked the right questions and gotten the answers that they need. If they still feel they need to be taking part in the clinical trial, then it's a wonderful opportunity for them to do so.
Mm-hmm. Just trying to think of different ways, you know, to get them to the trial.
Yeah. And also it's through organizations like Help for HD to put information out about specific clinical trials. Let's say that an organization, a company came to you and said, we're doing this study, we'd like to get the word out in this specific region. Maybe that's something you can help with as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, and through support group meetings and
things like
that too.
I want to just quickly touch on situations where the cognition is not what it could be, and what happens in those types of situations. So informed consent is very much based upon the ability of the person to give the informed consent. And if there's a situation where a patient is losing their cognition, then extra care will have to be taken to make sure that their desires are taken into account. So there may be a need to bring someone else on board as a so-called surrogate. So the person that's the surrogate could be a relative, close relative. It could be someone that is trustworthy and that has some sort of oversight over that patient. They would then be the ones that would give the informed consent. And the idea is that there is a potential for benefit for this patient to be in the trial. If there's no potential for benefit, I doubt that it would be appropriate to put the patient in a study in that type of situation. So there should be a potential for benefit. And it's always important to make sure that there is no coercion or undue influence in influencing them to take part in a study they really don't want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a process. There are different types of processes, and it would obviously be something that the sponsor would define for that type of situation, especially if they're studying patients with very severe and advanced Huntington's disease and cognition has been impacted, and maybe the whole idea of the drug might be to improve their cognition, then it would be important to make sure that when you are overseeing this whole process and helping that patient to determine if it's in their best interest to be in the study, that these procedures are also in place. So there's the so-called surrogate consent, and making sure that there's safeguard for the patient if they're a high-risk and very vulnerable patient, and where there's any doubt, they should not participate in the study. So those are just some extra considerations in terms of the informed consent that are a little bit unique for this disease area, but not only to this disease area. Alzheimer's is another aspect, another disease where this type of aspect might be important to take into account.
That's pretty much.
And I don't know if there are any questions.
Visit, right?
It could be something that you have to reevaluate at each visit, because sometimes people are in and out of cognitive impairment. So Alzheimer's disease is a little bit like that, where today they may be not very much with it, but tomorrow they could be very much clued in, and so they may change their mind. And if there's any doubt at all, the patient has the right to drop out of the clinical trial. And so there's no, the idea is that there's no coercion, there's no forcing the patient to remain in a study that really they don't want to be in. Mm-hmm. Especially where if there's a study that causes discomfort in some way, you've really got to pay very careful attention to that. And patient advocates and the so-called surrogate is very important, advocating for the patient, watching out for the patient, and making sure that whatever they're doing, whatever's being done to the patient is in their best interest.
And the surrogate, would that be somebody who is legally their care
Good question. It could be somebody that's legally their carer. It could also
guardian,
be a son or a daughter. It could be a relative. It could be someone that has the oversight even of their estate. Mm-hmm. But it's someone that has the best interest, hopefully someone that has the best interest of the patient in mind and is in some way qualified. So there are special forms that would have to be filled in. And it could vary from state to state. I looked up the requirements for the California. It can also vary from country to country as well. So these are sort of unique things that when the sponsor puts the study protocol together, they will bear that in mind in terms of what forms do we need for the U.S., what forms do we need for California, what forms do we need for Michigan, for instance, what forms do we need in Japan, what forms do we need in the UK, and they'll make sure those forms are part of the package that the patient sees or that the investigator would make sure they're using and following for that particular territory for this study.
There's so much to it, right? There's so much
There's a lot, yeah. There's a lot to it, especially where there's any risk of coercion or any risk of the patient not being able to give their own informed consent.
What is the policy on advertising for clinical trials?
Well, you can advertise, but what you have to be careful of is that you do not induce the patient to come into a study. So, for instance, you should not advertise in such a way that you're making the patient join the study because it's going to be to their financial benefit to do so.
Right.
So that would imply or induce patients to take part in a study that they perhaps should not be in. So if you advertise that there's a $250,000 payment, for instance, for taking part in study A, then of course a lot of people will want to be in the study because it's like they're winning the jackpot, but that's an inducement.
Right.
That's not what this is about. You don't want to advertise the money side of it. And
no.
Even when you do pay expenses, it's got to be proportionate to what the patient is out of pocket. So you've got to be careful of inducements. But in terms of advertising, there's so many different avenues, and you can advertise, but what you can't say is that this drug can treat something. You've got to make clear this is an investigational drug.
Right.
It's under study. This study is under IND or it's under investigational evaluation. And you would be a research subject. You can't say that this drug is going to cure your Huntington's disease.
Right.
So that would be false because it's not already gone through the whole process.
Okay, I have another question here. It seems like pharmaceutical companies are starting to look at old drugs or repurposing certain compounds. Is that something, is that a trend? Is that something that's working in other countries? What's happening with
that? It's a very good question. It's actually becoming more common than it was, but it's always been around where the originator company registers the drug in a certain number of indications. As part of the line extension, it's called a line extension, so that means you want to get new indications for that drug. And if you've spent several million bringing the drug to market, you want to maximize the return on investment. And the way that that's done is you find new indications, you patent those new indications, and you study it in those new disease areas, and then the treatment is given to those new disease areas. What's being done now as well is that companies that do not own the drug are now also using the drug after it's off patent to try to find new treatments for it. And there are challenges with trying to do that because you still have to find the money to support the studies that you want to do. And if you don't get the investors to invest in that study or the program of study, then it's virtually impossible. The governments are, like NIH, are probably one of the biggest proponents of this idea of repurposing. And it's usually government money that's going to do it, and investors are less likely to be as interested in this area. Unless you can patent a formulation, unless you can find something that is going to give you a unique advantage in the marketplace, because if you can't, even after investors would have spent the money developing the treatments, and then when the treatment comes out, all the physicians would have to do is write a prescription for the generic, which would be probably sold for pennies on the dollar, mm-hmm. and yet you spent several, maybe 10 million, 20 million developing it. So how do they get their money back? How do they get their return on investment? And it's sad that it does come down to the business aspect at the end of the day. And so there has to be, it has to make sense from a business perspective as well. And know that we wish we lived in a perfect world where it wouldn't come down to money, but unfortunately, in the real world, it does. And there are so many potential treatments around this idea of the breakthrough, the potential breakthrough therapy designation, which the U.S. FDA has brought out. I think that's one of the best things they could have done, because it's really moving companies to think, how do we get this disease treated at the very root of its cause, whatever the disease is? And as companies focus their efforts on finding breakthrough therapies, then I think there's going to be less interest in looking for things that treat symptoms. And a lot of the treatments that may have been already on the market for a long time and now they're generics. And, yeah, there may be academic institutions that are interested in looking at those for new diseases. At the end of the day, they will probably only get developed in a true sense if there is a potential for people to invest in them, investors to invest and get their return on investment.
How long is a drug patent typically?
It's over 20 years. Don't quote me on that, but it's substantially long. But what happens is you're eating into the patent while you're doing the development. So you get the patent, you develop the drug, and then what happens at the end of the day is that you may have another 10 years of patent life left, and then there are different mechanisms in different territories like the U.S. and Europe to return some of that investment in terms of the patent life. So it's a quite a complex question to answer as well. But there is a length of time that you get the patent for, and then after you get approval, there's some time returned back to the duration of the patent. There's also so-called exclusivity. And in rare diseases, there's a 10-year exclusivity, which means that no one else can develop or come and compete with you while you have that exclusivity in place. So there are some additional advantages to working in the rare disease area besides the patent or in addition to the patent.
And that's only in rare diseases?
It's mostly in rare diseases, also pediatric as well. It's another area where there's some exclusivity.
Can you talk to us, this is something that has come up in past conversations, but can you talk to us and explain to us what fast-tracking is?
Yes, fast-track is a U.S. term, and it's also a U.S. mechanism, so the FDA will provide a fast-track designation. So it's really like a label that the drug gets if it meets certain criteria, one of the criteria is that the drug is for a life-threatening disease area, and the FDA has a list of life-threatening diseases. So before a company can get a fast track, they have to apply for it. But when they do have the fast track, it just means that the FDA will spend a little bit more time with them, having meetings with them, and will help them with the design of their clinical trials and also the submission, during the submission process. They get a little bit more priority. It also gives them...
Is it hard to get?
Well, I suppose it depends on the drug. Not necessarily harder to get than anything else if the drug is a good drug that meets the criteria. But you've got to apply for it. The other thing is that they are able to do rolling submissions. So with a fast track, you don't have to submit the new drug application all in one go. You can submit one portion of it and then another portion and then the last portion. So you can submit it in pieces. So you can submit all the toxicology information when it's ready, all the CMC when it's ready, and all the clinical when it's ready. There are some disadvantages to doing that. You've got to be very organized to be able to do that. But that's the purpose of Fast Track, is to really give the drug like a priority status. There's also other statuses that the drug can have as well in the U.S. Priority review is one, which means that instead of a 13-month review period, there's 6 months. And so 6 months can make a big difference in terms of getting the drug to the patient. If it only takes 6 months to review the drug rather than 12 or 13, then the patients can see the drug a lot sooner. And it's also worth a lot more money to the pharmaceutical companies as well. So it's a big incentive. And it just means that the drug has achieved a standard of performance. That's why the FDA is giving it that priority review. So they're dropping other things while they spend time reviewing that drug because it's so important that they get it to the patients.
Mm-hmm. I think they've done that with ALS.
Yes. It's really drug-driven rather than... But if your drug really has an impact on a disease, ALS, Huntington's disease, oncology, any cancers, mm-hmm. it will get priority review if it has efficacy.
Mm-hmm. You have to prove efficacy first?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's part of the criteria.
That's part of the criteria that
There's
you have
probably a long that, list.
Yeah, that show that it works. The drug is mm-hmm. producing effects on the endpoints that you chose in a substantial enough number of patients.
Very interesting. Let's talk about your book, because can you believe it's 422 already?
Wow, the time's gone very quickly. Very enjoyable. So
I actually wrote
my book, Clinical Trials. Go ahead, Melissa.
What I wanted to say to our listeners is Dr. Speed is a very, very amazing woman. She's got a background that I've never seen before, and we could actually do a series with her for a year and still learn. So I'm very... honored that you're on the show with us today.
Well, thank
you
very much.
Your book.
Pleasure.
Sorry,
pleasure to be here, and I'm really enjoying it.
Good.
And the book is called Clinical Trials: What Patients and Healthy Volunteers Need to Know. It's published by Oxford University Press, so it is published by a major publisher. But I want to say that it was very difficult to find a good publisher for a book like this, simply because it's not a book that a famous person is writing about their life. And these types of book where the patients are really empowered and given information that they can use are so valuable to the patient, but often to no one else. And so it took a lot to find a really good publisher, but I'm so grateful to Oxford University Press for seeing the value, and I'm very grateful to Joan Bossart, her name is. She's the major editor at Oxford University Press based out of New York. And she saw the value immediately when she saw the product concept, and she wanted to publish it. And so we worked very hard on it for at least a year, and then it became a book. And this is a book that when it's in the hands of a patient, it's a reference book, but it's also a book that hopefully you will enjoy reading and finding out about the drug development process in general. And what it's a workbook too, because as you go into the investigator, you can ask, you know, what questions to ask. It also gives some stories, little anecdotes about different types of patients. So it's an educational, almost like a training manual about different types of situations that you could find yourself in as a patient. So it's not just for, it certainly isn't for Huntington's disease only, but it's applicable across many different disease areas.
Excellent. And they can find it at
OUP, there's a link. I did send it to you,
yes,
but
and
maybe
I've
there's
put
a
the
way
link
for you
into
to
the chat room.
Them.
Yeah. Then I'll also put the link on Facebook page, and then enter the promo code 32990.
Yes.
And I've also posted the flyer. So, and at the end of the week, I'll be publishing some news articles on the Huntington's Post, which I will also include. We'll get this out there. And, you know, this is really important and vital information for our community, for any disease community that is looking to participate or even learn about clinical trials.
And the other thing, Melissa, is that Oxford University Press are giving back a little bit of money per book sold back to Help for HD. So that's their way to make a contribution back to this disease area.
Thank you so much. We so appreciate that. And, you know, without clinical trials, we're not going to have treatments or therapies, or even the cure won't come unless we participate or, you know, support clinical trials.
Yes.
And that's how we move forward. That's how we empower ourselves, as you stated. Empowering ourselves with knowledge is really important to all of us. And also to help our loved ones who are suffering with this disease. You know, we want to help them as much as we can. And some people, some HD individuals may not be able to participate. My son is one that has not been able to participate in very many. And on the other hand, our VP, Katie, and her husband have participated in 5 clinical trials for HD. So,
Wonderful.
Yeah, we just need to get that information out there.
Yes. And I just want to thank you, Melissa, for your sacrifice and all that you do. I mean, you've just come out of a wonderful conference, and you're immediately doing this radio show. It just shows your commitment to this whole disease area and the patients, and I very laudable.
I have to say I was kind of a slug for a week. Well deserved.
Still recovering.
Yes, but it was a fabulous event, and we met so many new people and brought the community together. We really did bridge research and care and industry and community. It was just a fantastic event, and we're looking forward to the next one. Already we're planning next year's event will be in Riverside,
Wonderful.
California.
Yes.
And so that'll be fun. But it's been a great informational show, and Dr. Speed, thank you so much. And
thank you. Well, I'm glad to be here, and we look forward to future participation and collaboration.
Yes, and actually, Dr. Speed will be on again in September on the 16th, and I think we'll have another guest with us, Dan, at that time.
Yes, Dan Van Kamen is a drug developer, and he has very unique skill sets and interests, as well as background in developing potential treatments for Huntington's disease. So we look forward to hearing from him. I'll be interviewing him, that's the plan, on what the latest developments are in Huntington's disease.
Yes. Okay, so that'll be on the 16th of September.
Yes.
And
if he can speed for that date, we'll have to check with him, but that's the proposed date at the moment.
You are an amazing woman, and I can't wait to have another show with you and get to know you better. So I appreciate all that you do. And I'm
pleasure.
So happy that you've met the community.
Thank you.
So, yes, thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And be sure to come back and listen to the on-demand episodes. We're archived on Blog Talk Radio and on iTunes. So just type in Help for HD on iTunes, and we should pop right up. Don't forget to tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD International and Help for HD Radio. And we will talk to you next week. Everyone have a great night. Dr. Speed, go ahead and stay with me, and I'll put on a song, and you and I will talk in the screen room. Have a great week, everyone.
Thank you.
Talk to you next week.
Bye.
That you settled down, that you found a girl and you married now. I heard that your dreams came true. Guess she gave you things I didn't give to you. Couldn't fight it. I had hoped you'd see my face and that you'd be reminded that for me it isn't over. Never mind, I'll find someone like you. I wish nothing but the best for you too. Don't forget me, I beg. I'll remember you. Fight it. I had hoped you'd see my face and that you'd be reminded that for me it isn't over. Never mind, I'll find someone like you. I wish nothing but the best for you too. Don't forget me, I beg. Nothing compares, no worries or cares, regrets and mistakes, their memories made. Who would have known how bittersweet this would taste? Never mind, I'll find someone like you. I wish nothing but the sometimes it hurts.